For the week of July 14th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 455, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And at Lords in London, England, I'm Michael Giltz.
Now, are you at Lords because, well, I would assume it's because you were there for the Cricket World Cup.
Of course I am. After the heartbreak of Wimbledon, oh, Roger, you broke my heart, truly. I rushed over to Lords to try and get some redemption, and there it was, finally, the men's cricket team beating New Zealand and becoming, for the first time in history, the best in the world. England invented cricket, but until 2 years ago, neither the men nor the women had ever been champions at World Cup. 2 years ago, the women did it. Wonderful, huzzah. And now finally the men have done it as well. For the first time ever, England is the greatest at cricket. The sport it invented. And you know what? They did it crazily. They didn't score more runs. They didn't take more wickets. They just scored more boundaries. It's as obscure a rule as you could ask for, but by God, they did it.
So, okay. Well, a couple things. And I'm going to put a pin in the boundaries thing for just a moment.
Okay.
When I was in New Zealand earlier this year, there were two things that dominated television, and it was not reality shows, although I guess you could say it was reality shows, because it was sports. Literally every channel had a rugby match on it. I don't know who these teams were. I didn't know there were so many teams in New Zealand that could play rugby, or in Australia. Rugby. But also cricket. Literally, there was cricket on morning, noon, and night.
Yes, there are many drawbacks to an empire, and one of them is teaching the colonial people to play the sport you love and finding out they're better at it than you are. Big mistake when you bring cricket to India and Pakistan and rugby to New Zealand. Just awful idea.
Well, here's the question. What is a boundary? Because I know that that's like when, if I'm not mistaken, it is when the ball, and I'm sure I just got that wrong. It's not a ball. It's is it a wicket that you? What is
the wicket is the thing at the
end. At the end, yeah. The little sticks at the end that you're trying to knock off.
Mm-hmm.
But so when the ball gets batted out of bounds, right? Mm-hmm. There's that little like rim at the edge of the field.
Right. It's the ground beyond any object that is grounded beyond the boundary. That's sort of rules to be allowed for boundaries with both captains. So it's not like hitting a home run, but that's probably an easy way for you to think about it. You know, they determine the boundary of the field of play, you identify and mark the boundary, and then, you know, you try to hit the ball out there sometimes, and that helps you, get ahead.
Yeah, you automatically get a certain number of runs, right?
Well, again, runs are a different thing. You know, boundaries, scoring a boundary is different from scoring a run. You can score runs, take wickets, and also score boundaries. So it's just a little thing. You know, you hit it out hard enough, far enough away, you get a certain thing.
Well, and it just goes to show you, our show is not longer than a cricket match, right?
Oh, heavens,
I mean, those
no.
things last days on end.
Well, but they also have rules for, you know, now to speed it up. So they have same day and, you know, games where it goes boom, boom, boom. So it's sort of caved to the modern era. So that's not true anymore, necessarily. Not all cricket takes days and days and days.
I know.
Well, there you go. So there you go. We try to be worldwide. It was scoring billions of video views in certain segments being watched. Some of the semis and finals had some of the best cricket numbers in a decade. So it has been scoring very well in ratings around the world, not here in the U.S. particularly. We're still catching up with football.
I could not find it. Could you find it?
No, I'm sure you would have had to go online, you know, to a website streamer. It wasn't on a cable channel.
I couldn't find it at all.
Yeah. ESPN7 does not carry it.
Yeah, that should tell you something.
But maybe we should, you know, start carrying cricket here in the U.S. We could get the rights and see how that works out because, you know, there is a trend. And there were like four or five of them that I thought, really? Why are you launching a production company? But the last few were like the Mandela family. The Nelson Mandela family is launching a production shingle. I'm thinking, hey, now? Like, why now suddenly? Why do you think you know what to do in production? And also the Build-A-Bear company. That's the company where you go and you build your own bear. You're probably familiar with the name, at least, even if you've never been there, right?
Yes, but the problem with that production company is if you are watching one of their productions, you have to make it yourself.
That's right, exactly. No, the crazy thing is, okay, Build-A-Bear is launching a production company, so you think whatever, they want IP, they want content, they want to promote the brand, and I assume it's going to be like, you know, about the bears or people building bears and how, what the world of that. No, their first step is to launch a record label because, of course, because of course they're a company that builds bears, so naturally they would want to have a record label. So And none of that makes sense, but it does point out the fact that we are behind the times. So Sperling and I want to announce now, Showbiz Sandbox is launching our own production company. We have VR, gaming, online gaming, video games, VR games. We have augmented reality. We have film, television, streaming. We're pitching stuff to Quibi. We are going to pitch stuff to Quibi. I've just done it by saying that. So we're very excited.
That is podcast. Our pitch. Podcast, that is our pitch. It's got to be short. It's got to be short. Our pitch is.
I don't think that's our sweet zone. I think our zone is long. And if we don't get to the episode, we're never going to get through this one. So tell me. Well, we know what's not going to be on the show this week, and that's Emmy nominations.
No, that's true, because unless we are Karnak, and by the way, that's a reference to Johnny Carson's character.
So that's how old I am.
Yeah. We cannot tell you about Emmy nominations because they are tomorrow.
Yes, we can. Today. We can tell you Emmy nominations. The Emmy nominations will be announced on Tuesday, probably when you're hearing this podcast. And some people will get nominated and it will be great. And some people will not and it will be outrageous. And some people will be nominated and it'll be terrible. You know, it's like it happens every year. So we'll figure it out. Let everybody yell and scream about it. And maybe next week we'll have something useful to say. And if we do, we will. But until then, we've got this week's episode. What are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're as proud as new parents over our exclusive, patented, copyrighted, only at Showbiz Sandbox guide to the week in box office. Our new approach to the box office numbers, available to everyone, by the way, keeps producing insights. This week, it's the smashing success of the arty horror flick, Midsommar. Now, I want you to pronounce that 5 times fast. Smashing success of the arty horror flick, Midsommar.
That is not easy. And by the way, our box office week, it's 4 weeks old. Aren't you a good little boy? Aren't you a good little girl? It's only four weeks old.
Not even smiling yet. Not even smiling.
No, not really.
By the way, its diaper needs to be changed. I'll leave that to you.
I'll do that later.
In the Middle Kingdom, a piece at Bloomberg woke us up to a key reason why censorship in China has proven so sloppy and unexpected. There's a new boss in town, actually, something we reported on before and then promptly forgot about. On Inside Baseball, we'll be talking about 2 more big changes roiling the entertainment business: Discovery Network's desire to change how reality shows are funded in the U.S., and Disney's desire to completely upend how profit participants cash out on hit TV shows. In other words, they want to keep all the cash and you can get out. Actually, that's pretty much. Apparently, it's not just the writers who want to change the rules governing the business. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office. You see, I had to untrain my brain from saying last weekend's box office. Yes, exactly.
Many years of doing that. If I knew some mnemonic device for how to do a diaper, I would have done that right now. Like, corner to the left, or it's like there's some little trick you did when you change diapers.
Yeah, safety pin on the nose and close your eyes and just hope. No,
on the nose. Well, anyway, we're looking at the week's box office. We're looking at the worldwide charts for the past 7 days. We pull information from ComScore. We have them, their chart in our show notes. We also have a chart from Box Office Mojo and links to their websites. We also pull information from Deadline Hollywood, the numbers, Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, the trades, Variety and Hollywood Reporter. I'm still hoping for some trade story covering China. And some other news, because I'm a little confused about Midsommar, but we'll get to that in a minute. And, you know, the New York Times, the LA Times, you, our listeners. And again, looking at the worldwide box office for the past week, if you listen to the people who talk about the North American box office, they will tell you that Spider-Man Far From Home grossed $45 million over the weekend. Isn't that exciting? But if people talk about the worldwide box office, they'll say, hold on a second, Spider-Man Far From Home grossed $145 million. Well, isn't that exciting? But actually, last week, Spider-Man Far From Home grossed $267 million. That's
just
a lot of
last
money.
Week. Just last week. Week. That's why it's almost up to, what is it, $850?
It's worldwide? At $850 million worldwide. This sucker blew past Toy Story 4. It's clearly going to blow past $1 billion. This movie is going to gross $1 billion when all is said and done. If not 1.1 or 1.2. We'll have to see what its legs are like. It's got 8 of them.
Oh!
Oh, I didn't even know I was going to do that.
And that's hilarious. Well, you know, here's the thing. Every time I think, oh, finally, I think we're finally, Avengers Endgame is over, and I think we're finally going to get past all this comic book superhero stuff. Now we can make real movies again. No. Spider-Man goes on to make $1 billion in like 10 days.
And these are not movies. This is a TV series. We just saw the end of season one with Avengers Endgame. Spider-Man Far From Home is the launch of season two, picking up right where the last one left off. You've got characters, you've got cliffhangers, you've got another episode coming in a few weeks. That's why there were just a few months barely between Avengers and Spider-Man Far From Home. There's three or four of these movies a year now. So this is like a TV show. It's the world's most expensive TV series. You're looking at a season, 20 episodes long, that costs, you know, so much money to make. I can't even add it all up.
Well, you know, so in a way, Quentin Tarantino was right. Now that movies are projected digitally, it's like, you know, when you go to the movies, you're just watching television with a group of people.
Yeah, I don't know if the display is the thing there. The picture quality can be great.
It's the content, I know, but I was just...
the quality can be great. But the quality of Toy Story 4 is good. That's the number two movie around the world. Last week, it grossed $121 million. It's at $771 million worldwide. Okay, Spider-Man Far From Home passed it up. Does that mean it's doing better? Well, yeah, it's grossing more money. But they're not competing against each other. Toy Story 4 cost $200 million to make. It's already in the black. It's more than tripled that budget. We know there's a ton of marketing involved, but we know this movie is going to be very profitable for Disney and already is from box office alone. At number three around the world is The White Storm 2, Drug Lords. This is the Hong Kong flick.
Wait, did you just pass number three?
Oh, I
see. I'm so sorry. That is my fault.
You're looking at ComScore.
I'm looking at ComScore, not our own patented, copyrighted list of the best movies of the week.
That's right. You have to. We have links to those other charts so you can see the difference. And then at the bottom, we have our own handwritten chart done with pen and paper by our own little team of statisticians with calculators and pencils flying. And that's right. The number three movie around the world is, in fact, The White Storm 2, Drug Lords. This is a Hong Kong flick. It stars Andy Lau, who also produced. It grossed $76 million last week. It's at $140 million worldwide.
Was there a White Storm 1? And if so, can I see it?
There was. They're barely related. That was like 8 or 10 years ago, I think, as I recall, when I was looking up info on White Storm 2. And they basically share a title. That's about all that the movies have in
common. You know what I really like about the James Bond franchise? I've always loved this. Is that, yes, there might be things that are related in the movies, narratively, so to speak. But all of their titles are the same, are different. They don't have like James Bond 15. And yes, I know that when they're making them, they're like Bond 25 or whatever.
Right.
But when the film is actually released, it's, you know, Quantum of Solace. It could be, you could watch them in any order you want.
It could be James Bond : and it's not. So that's nice.
Yes.
You could watch them in any order there, though I think the last few Daniel Craig had a certain progression to them. That's only what they were going for. But yeah, by and large, they're standalones, as they say in the book biz, and that's good. The one thing people say, they look at our notes and they're wondering how sometimes what we say on the show does not track with what is in our notes. For example, Spider-Man Far From Home, I said it's at about $850 million worldwide. Well, specifically, it's at $847 million worldwide. The White Storm 2, I said, is at $140 million. Well, it's at $138 million. We round up or down just a little bit because by the time you hear it, it'll be true. You know, Spider-Man will have grossed another $3 million by the time you hear this podcast. But also, it's just easier to hear when you're listening. It's easier to remember and picture $850 million than $847 million. You have to sort of process that, and it's a little vaguer. So we're just trying to make it easier for you to grasp where it is in general. So yeah,
does
we round
that
up.
Also work with politics, by the way? Because if so, I've got a few candidates I'd like to say are now, you know, holding certain offices, and other candidates not holding certain offices.
No, there you got to count every vote.
Oh, darn it.
And by vote, I mean electoral vote. Anyway, at number four around the world is The Lion King, which opened up in China. $55 million on its opening week, right about where they thought it would go. There's just some grumblings that maybe it should have done better and maybe it's not going to have as great a hole. But The Lion King original was not that big a deal. That was long before China had a robust theatrical biz. I think it grossed like $5 million or some crazy amount. In China, it was just not that big a hit, just like the Star Wars movies weren't that big a hit. So maybe The Lion King did not have the same power that even Aladdin has had. But
well, you know, I wish I worked and lived in London, because literally the premiere, the European premiere, was last night in
Leicester
London.
Square and, or something. Yeah, are you that excited?
No, I just, you know, everybody I know gets invited. Like, I don't know, like, movie stars. Okay, well, I do in certain instances, but no, it's not the movie stars that get invited. It's like every executive I know gets to go.
Oh, so, you mean in New York, in LA?
No, in London.
Oh, you mean they fly out for it?
No, they all live in London.
Oh, well, of course, so, yeah. Well, don't you get invited to LA premieres?
Sometimes, but most of the time, you know, because LA, you know, there's so many people in this business in LA, they can't invite everybody in LA. Whereas in London, it's like, no, they invited everybody that works in the business in London to the
premiere. You were there for the world premiere of Quentin Tarantino's movie. Isn't that more important than worrying about the Lion King?
Fine.
Yeah, you're a con, baby. All right, at number five around the world is Aladdin, another Disney live action remake. Making tons of money, but Sperling and I argue they are hurting their brand. We really think that's true. $39 million Aladdin made last week. It's at $960 million. Another movie that is going to blow past the $1 billion mark. In about 2 minutes, you're going to be looking at the top 100 films of all time worldwide, and they will all be at $1 billion.
And they will all be from Disney. No, just kidding. That said, okay, Aladdin, right? Here's a movie that I think is going to lose a lot of, as they say, dates, you know, in the biz. They're going to lose a lot of play dates this week, because with The Lion King, is The Lion King being released this week? I think it is,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So
I believe so, yeah.
You got Disney out there with Avengers is still going, right? You've got The Lion King. You've got Toy Story 4.
Yeah, Disney wants every screen that you've got. I don't know, because there's so much room now. I feel like multiplexes have so much room and so many screens. It's true that first few days they will put The Lion King on 18 screens, but then it'll come back down a bit. They'll still have the prime screen, the prime dates, but they can fit in other. I mean, you look at what's playing in your theaters. There are movies that have been out for weeks and weeks and weeks that still have play dates, because it's so easy to throw in some dates for them. It's just a simple thing to do now with digital, that I feel like movies are getting a little bit longer runs again if there's some demand.
Yeah, maybe. You know,
yeah, no, I think Aladdin will I don't think Aladdin will have any trouble getting to a billion, though. Another $40 million worldwide.
Oh, it'll get there.
Yeah. And number six is Annabelle Comes Home, the latest in the Conjuring franchise. That's at $38 million worldwide. That's what it made last week. And its total is $175 million and counting. And number seven is The Secret Life of Pets 2. That's still making good money. It's at $36 million this week. That's what it pulled in. And it's just passing $300 million worldwide. Again, the original made triple that, almost $900 million. So this is sort of a classic sequel. It used to be, when you made a sequel, you hoped to make a third or a half of what the original made, because there was no reason to make a sequel. Nobody was waiting for a sequel, but you were just trading on the goodwill of the original film. Oh, well. At number eight is a bit of a puzzle. This is Midsommar. The art house successful. What is the thing I'm supposed to say that's really hard?
Oh, you mean the thing you're supposed to say five times
fast? Yeah, because then Beetlejuice
you're supposed
shows
to say it's the smashing success of the arty horror flick Midsommar. You see, I can't even do it.
The smashing success of the arty horror flick Midsommar. All right. Well, this movie cost $9 million to make. It grossed last week? I'm not sure. If you look at the chart from Box Office Mojo, Midsommar made $3.5 million in North America. It's at $18 million and counting in the U.S. alone. If you look at the worldwide charts, Midsommar was at number 11. Worldwide, it grossed $4.3 million over the weekend. But its total is $44.8 million. Last week, when it opened up, its worldwide total was just $11 million. That means it's made $34 million over the last week. So from $4 million on the worldwide chart, it jumps up to $34 million. So, I've looked and I've gotten multiple sources that its worldwide total is $44 to $45 million. I have looked at some new territories where it opened up. I have not been able to find any big numbers. Maybe it opened up on a Tuesday or Wednesday in lots of places. You know, I'm just not sure where the Monday through Thursday money came from that got it up to all this money, and why it's not reflected in the weekend chart for Comscore. But the worldwide total is $44.8 million. Last week it was at just barely $11 million. So that gets us to $34 million last week.
Well, okay, let's just take the US because that's all I've got right now.
That's $18 million total.
Right. So if you look at it, right, you got...
It made $7 million last week in the US alone.
Yeah. On Wednesday, it made $923,000.
It made $7 million from Monday through Sunday. $7 million.
And looking at what it made Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, like looking at the actuals, I can say, you know, it made $1.2 million on Tuesday. Yeah, I could see it making $7 million during the week.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So which is, by the way, more than the 3.5 that it made on the weekend. So why not report all of it?
Right. But when we look at the chart worldwide, it's only in four territories.
Yes.
But according to ComScore, but according to Box, the numbers is in 10 territories. So, you know, again, if people don't report to ComScore or they don't have those people in their track, they're not getting all that information. So the numbers thinks it's playing in 10 territories. ComScore thinks it's playing in four territories. But everybody agrees its worldwide total is $45 million. That means this movie, which cost $9 million to make, is now at a very robust $45 million worldwide. So it's already a successful hit film. It's more than, it's quadrupled its budget. So this movie's just, no, I'm sorry, making five times its budget. So, and it tore it up last week, $34 million. So we'll have to see where it ends up. But this sucker is tearing it up. It's doing a lot better than you would think if you looked at just the weekend. And there are some territories that are not reporting this clearly. So, you know, we are just playing fast and loose. We're looking at the same numbers everyone else has. We're just using math to say, well, we know what it made last week. And now it's at this week. How much more money is that? So that's how we're coming up with our numbers. When we find something unusual like this, this huge jump from $4 million on the weekend to $34 million, we do go around and say, hey, have we missed something? Are we making a mistake here? As far as we can tell, this is right. So that's a big, big jump from Midsummer, and that's making a lot of money. And number nine is another movie doing quite well. It's Yesterday, the Beatles flick, $23 million it made last week. It's at $80 million and counting worldwide. This one is proving audience friendly. Critics were sort of mixed on it, but audiences really like it, and it's going to play and play. And number 10 is Crawl, the alligators attack film. Don't ask me why or how, but for some reason, I saw it over the weekend. I just was in the mood for a dumb movie, and it was dumb. I cannot recommend it, I'm afraid.
Would you have seen this movie if you weren't an AMC A-list member?
Hell no.
Yeah, there you go. That is how subscriptions work.
That's right. So I saw the movie and I potentially could have bought popcorn and soda if it wasn't the size of a small city. But this movie cost about $14 million to make. It grossed $17 million on its opening week. And number 11 is another film that opened up. People basically said both Crawl and Stuber, the Uber driver comedy, were hurt by the continued success of Spider-Man Far From Home. I would say more that they were hurt by the fact that they're just not very good movies and didn't really appeal to audiences, you know?
Stuber, the trailer on Stuber looks amazing. But
well, there you go. If you think so.
That said, it also looks like all of the jokes are in the trailer.
It looks very, very VCR-able, as we used to, you know. Oh, I can wait for VCR as we stay back in the old. I can wait for Blockbuster. Now I can wait for Netflix or whatever people say.
And that's exactly what it looks like. Oh, that's going to be a great movie on a plane.
Not great. Yeah, on a plane. Yeah. So it grossed $11 million in its opening week. It's not bad. It only costs $16 million to make. It'll probably end up being just fine. Then here we are. We'll get to Avengers Endgame in a second. Go to the bottom of the list for one new film on the list, one final new film. This is a Japanese anime film that opened up in China, I believe, based on the distributor that's listed. I thought they really messed up the title of the movie from translation problems. But in fact, it seems like it actually is the title. There's a slash in the name. So, you know, a leaning to the right line. So I'm not saying slash the word, but the name of this movie is Fate / Stay Night, Heaven's Field 2, Lost Butterfly, which sounds like a haiku. What? It sounds like a haiku.
It's a Chinese film. You know, it's funny.
A Japanese anime.
Oh, okay. All right. All right.
It's
Sorry.
Second in a trilogy. It's the third one is coming out in 2020. It's already played in most of the world, including the US. And now it's opened up in China, where it made $3 million last week. Its total seems to be about $20 million. I do love the title, though. Fate, Stay Night, Heaven's Field 2, Lost Butterfly. Anyway, in limited release, The Farewell opened up in North America, had a great start. It's on four screens and it made $87,000 per screen.
This is a great movie. This is well worth seeing.
Well, and our in-house film critic, Aaron Rich, also liked it. He thought it was very good. He thought it was very good, and Awkwafina was terrific, he thought. And so he recommends it as well. However,
I'll say this. If you don't like Awkwafina based on her previous performances, you know.
And I didn't particularly.
Okay, I will say this. She does not come off as Awkwafina.
She's not doing her shtick. She's giving a performance.
It's like, you know, I don't know why they cast her, because it could have been, I mean, but she pulls it off. It's a very good story.
Well, and I have to point to a new thing that annoys me. Every weekend, there's the box office, and then there's a story on Monday. Why did Stuber fail? Or the seven reasons Spider-Man Far From Home did well. It's like, there's no need to explain every movie's success or failure at the box office. We don't need in-depth analysis. Sometimes it's pretty obvious. And after The Farewell, they said, can Farewell break out? Well, sure, maybe. Got great reviews, had a great strong opening, and now we'll have to see how they expand it. But, you know,
and we do not talking about it. Good word of mouth.
Right. We don't need x-rays of every single stupid film. If there's something interesting and unusual to say, or it brings insight into some trend at the box office, great. But otherwise saying, why Toy Story 4 underperformed, but we'll still be fine. It's like, oh, just shut up.
Well, and that is why you will never be the editor of People.com, UsWeekly.com, any one of those things, because
it's the trades.
Oh, the trades?
I'm talking about
trades. They need clickbait too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of clickbait, you know, we don't always get everything right here. We were talking about China censorship and what was going on in that country. And I'd forgotten one detail, but a story by Adam Minter at Bloomberg reminded me certainly, that this censorship, and it's become sort of clumsier. That's how we would describe in the last year. You know, they're censoring movies minutes before they hit the theaters, when for God's sake, it's their own film made in their own country, coming to their own film festival. You know, they had ample opportunity to get this right, and they're screwing it up. But the point is that there's a new boss in town. It's the Central Propaganda Department. We reported on this before. There used to be different divisions of the government that would censor films and give approval and that sort of thing. And that power was consolidated into a new department called the Central Propaganda Department, and it's closer in spirit, at least, to the Communist Party. Of course, the whole government is run by, it's a single party state, it's not a democracy, and so everybody responds to the Communist Party, but this is more in tune with saying, no, we will institute our Communist Party, you know, they're more in tune with the propaganda they want to promote rather than capitalism, or should say the success of their industry. They have a different metric, and more importantly, they're not very good at their job yet. So maybe the problem is they read a script and didn't quite spot the problems, or didn't realize what it would look like when it was on the big screen, because that's not an easy skill.
And if you think about it, a lot of these productions were approved with the previous regime and are now being
that was a year ago though. They've came into power like over a year ago. So this is not, you know, yesterday's, but maybe yeah. But again, if something was already in the process, they could have stopped it. Or they're going to say, well, hey, by the way, that's not happening. You know, that movie about Chiang Kai-shek being a hero, we're not going to have that on our screen. But anyway, that's a good explanation of, hey, it's one other wrinkle here is that they are new to the job, relatively speaking. It's only been a year. So there were some projects in the pipeline. And also, they just might not be good at it. You know, it's, you know, one thing to read something on a piece of paper, another thing to see it suddenly a week before it opening, you're looking at the movie going, oh my God, we can't have this.
Well, and now you have all of these films that, you know, will be eagerly anticipated, you know, decades in the future, the long lost films of, you know, all, during this time period.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's always a big deal when you can, you know, excavate a movie from the past that's been hidden. And I hope we don't have to wait 20 or 30 years to see The 800, because I'm interested in checking it out.
Wait, did you say
what?
The 800?
What? No. Yes, I did.
Or Big Deal.
Oh, I don't know. Did I?
Because if you said Big Deal, it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Faster, faster.
Okay, well, our first story. Pop star Nicki Minaj has pulled out of a concert in Saudi Arabia.
Yay!
After the Human Rights Foundation publicly urged her to reconsider. In a statement, Minaj said, "After better educating myself on the issues, I believe it is important for me to make clear my support for the rights of women, the LGBTQ community, and freedom of expression." Well, good for her. Nonetheless, numerous artists continue to perform in countries suffering under repressive regimes that do not respect basic human rights, such as, say, you know, the United Arab Emirates would be an example, and other politically questionable hotspots around the world. Liam Payne, formerly of One Direction, is still scheduled to perform at the Saudi concert, and other recent stars ready to cash a check from the Saudis include Black Eyed Peas, Sean Paul, Enrique Iglesias, and of course, Mariah Carey. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
It's a big deal because she's one of the first one in a while to say, wait, this isn't acceptable, or this is going to hurt my brand, more to the point, perhaps. And so she's not willing to pay that price. These other people took the check. They didn't care. Mariah Carey does this all the time. It's despicable. And, you know, just like not playing in apartheid South Africa until it becomes unacceptable, these people are going to keep doing it. So people fight and yell and scream every time someone performs in Israel, one way or the other. But there's no debate when it comes to appearing in Qatar or the UAE or Saudi Arabia or for a dictator. You know, that should just not even be close to a questionable call. That's not politics. That's just common decency. And until they pay a price, they're going to keep doing it. But now Nicki Minaj has said, you know what? That's not worth it for me. And another artist is going to be a lot harder for them to do that and take that check. So good for Nicki Minaj. And boy, Liam Payne. He broke up One Direction. He wants to make us hate him? What is his problem?
So no one told you life was going to be this way? You had a Netflix subscription, and that gave you access to the entire run of The Office and Friends and so many other shows and movies, along with originals like Stranger Things. But at some point, you have to grow up and move on, and maybe stop living with your roommates, for Pete's sake.
No.
So The Office is heading to Universal's new streaming service, and starting in 2020, Friends is moving to the new Warner Media streaming service. And by the way, that site is now officially known as HBO Max, which makes me think of HBO and Cinemax, but here it is. You know, it just means HBO on steroids, I guess. With lots of original content from Warner Brothers, including Friends, and everything from the CW. So Michael doesn't have to wonder where to go when he needs to binge watch One Tree Hill. Warner Media says it outbid others, including Netflix, by paying $425 million for 5 years worth of Friends episodes. Who says you can't buy Friends? You can. You just need about $500 million to do it. Big deal or big whoop?
I am definitely available for friendship for $425 million over 5 years. Man, my voice is going this week. And by the way, you should have begun that story with, so no one told you life was going to be this way.
Could you tell that I realized
like,
that halfway through?
You're like, I blew that one.
Yeah,
that's
maybe
reading the script.
Maybe I could actually turn it into a question, which I did, even though it wasn't written that way.
Yes, so this is interesting. Again, the value in these older shows is remarkable. I wish we had actual figures from Netflix to know how much, you know, all that speculation about The Office and Friends being, you know, really, really popular on Netflix, we don't really know. We don't know how much people are watching or what level. We know how big Friends was in syndication. And we know that The Office was not a big hit when it was on the air. Never broke into the top 40, by the way. 9 seasons it ran. Not once was The Office in the top 40. Not a big hit.
However, yet people talk about it. My kids love that show.
Right. Well, that's the power of syndication and streaming. Shows can become big hits once it starts repeating. That's happened before. You know, Gilligan's Island wasn't that big a hit, but everybody knows it. But The Office was a big hit for 2 years in demos. People love demos. I don't. But the 18 to 49, season 6 and 7, it really clicked. It started to build and build and build. And then I assume it went into syndication because it was over 5 years, which means people started to see the reruns. And maybe this was before streaming. And then with streaming, maybe it was available somewhere streaming. But suddenly people were catching up on the earlier seasons. And that sort of skyrocketed the ratings among young people. Season 6 and 7, it was ranked number 11, way up there in the 18 to 49 demo. Still didn't break into the top 40 overall, but it still was scoring big. And this was briefly late in the run, and then it fell apart again because Steve Carell left and the last 2 seasons were dumb. But anyway, so, you know, that show was a late blooming hit, and that matters because we're going to talk about that more in Inside Baseball. But the one thing here I think is interesting is HBO Max.
Yeah, what is that? Why do you have to name it HBO? It's not HBO. Just name it something else.
But
name
isn't that
Warner
Max? That's what's so fascinating. The HBO is more valuable than calling it Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers Plus, or Warner Brothers Extreme, or Warner Brothers whatever, they realized HBO is a more valuable name when it comes to streaming and television than Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers hasn't had they have WBTV for a while, didn't they? But, you know, just not a big name in television. People don't associate Warner Brothers with ER and all the big hits they've had. The name in television that they associate with quality is HBO. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake. To be honest.
Why is that? Because it dilutes the HBO brand? Or?
Well, I think HBO is a brand, and you're now
quality.
Having that brand subsume a brand with 100 years of history that, frankly, should have its own brand, Warner Brothers.
Well, and now it's also really messed them up with pricing in a way, because you're going to have all of HBO on there, which means you can't charge less than HBO and HBO Plus and HBO To Go, whatever it's called. You know, people who want HBO without subscribing to cable, you can't charge less than $15 because that's what they charge, which means you got to charge a little bit more because you're adding all this extra stuff. So how much do you think they're going to charge for HBO Max? And compare that to Disney's $7 or Netflix's, what is it, $12,
$14? Let's call it 12.
Okay, yeah. So depending on how many channels you want to stream at once and the quality. So $12, $14. You're going to be the priciest one in town? Okay, but people might get a sticker shock of looking at $18. I'll tell you that much.
Well, you know, there is a long history of, maybe not a long history, but some history of, you know, big giant corporations purchasing Warner Brothers and then completely botching the management of them.
Warner Brothers has a long history. That sounds like MGM to me. But
AOL, anyone?
Oh, well, that, yeah, yeah.
But
that
was, you see, that we've already forgotten about it.
Well, that was more than Warner. That was Time Warner. There was lots of things, not just Warner Brothers. I don't think the studio is wildly mismanaged. The corporate owners, yes, but the studio to me hasn't been knocked around or hollowed out the way MGM was.
The last couple of years, there's, you know, what with the whole Susie Hara thing, and then, you know, the having three, no head of the studio, but having three people run it.
Right.
Yeah, that was an issue, but that's a blip on the radar compared to the long history of Warner Brothers.
We've really gone long here, but looking at The Office and checking out its ratings and all that, I realized that for like a decade, NBC did not have any scripted hits, like nothing. Nothing in the top 40. Nothing. 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 All they had for you.
Was it something or was it?
All they had. And then eventually they got a non-scripted hit with The Voice. And that was it. They had nothing. And finally, you know what their first big hit in like a decade was? It was The Blacklist.
Yes.
I mean, NBC really has not had hits for a long, long time. Really shocking to me, actually, because that's the network I imagined from my, you know, the glory days of The Cosby Show and Family Ties and Cheers and all that. Well, you know, there you go. A lot of money being spent on TV.
Yeah. In fact, what was completely unrelated news until you just said that, Netflix is spending more money than ever before on a single film. So I guess maybe it is unrelated because one is TV and one is film.
It's film airing on TV.
That's true.
It's a TV movie.
Well, in this case, we're talking about Red Notice. It's an action film starring Dwayne Johnson, Gal Gadot, and Ryan Reynolds. That's not going to cost too much. It was at Universal until the studio cut it free and Netflix jumped. All three stars will be getting a measly $20 million plus. Oh, by the way, Johnson gets more thanks to a producer credit. The thriller is about an Interpol agent chasing the world's most successful art thief. Hilariously, no matter who you imagine in what role, it seems kind of like silly casting, doesn't it? The final budget looks to hit $200 million. Other big budget plays by Netflix include the Martin Scorsese film The Irishman, which I think is going to be viewable in some form or fashion later this year. Also creeping up to $200 million. That's how much that film is costing. And the Michael Bay flick, Six Underground, about billionaires who fake their own deaths so they can hunt down criminals or do podcasts about entertainment news. Oh, I'm sorry. That film, the Six Underground, it stars Ryan Reynolds. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal because I don't get it. I mean, you're looking at $550 million, assuming that last foot costs $150 million. $500 million at least for what, 5.5 hours of television?
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, how many subscribers do you think you will get and or keep by spending that much money on one movie?
And it's for movies that you'd rather see in a theater.
Yes.
You know, wouldn't you rather see Red Notice if it's any good in a movie theater first? I know I would.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Just it'd be more fun if it's an actual successful action flick. Those play better on a big screen. And, my niece was sick and she's at home and I come over and brought some food to her and she was watching the Adam Sandler, Jennifer Aniston travesty, whatever that horrible little detective movie was that got poisonous reviews. And she's there happily watching it. I'm like, how is it? She's like, oh, it's good. It's fine. She goes, and Netflix makes good cheese. That's what she said. Netflix makes good cheese, like Bird Box and that, and stuff that maybe Lifetime Once Upon a Time produced, or bland comedies and romantic comedies that the studios aren't making anymore. But that's kind of a good niche, something that other people aren't making. I'd rather make 10 films with Adam Sandler than Red Notice. I would, because I think that's going to be more.
I honestly believe that Netflix is doing that. They're doing both. They're making Red Notice and 10 films with Adam
Sandler. Don't have unlimited money. $500 million for three movies. To me, why are you chasing the prestige of a Martin Scorsese film that costs $200 million, more money than he's ever spent? That'd be stupid for any studio to make. I wouldn't greenlight that if I was Disney or Warner Brothers, because that's not a movie I want to make. A $200 million Martin Scorsese flick? No, thank you.
Didn't somebody already do that? They called it Gangs of New York. Oh, that was only $125 million.
It was $125 million, but it was also a commercial flop, you know, commercial, right. Not a success story. So, you know, the amount of TV content they could make and shows that they could launch and maybe hit on something that hits and can run for, God forbid, more than three seasons, which I also think is a mistake, killing everything off after three seasons, which seems to be what everyone does just because of their stupid contract multipliers. So I think if I got $500 million to play with, I'm not making three movies. Not if I'm a TV service that wants content. That seems a really dumb thing to do. They just want to chase the prestige of playing with these big stars. And what's the result? They get a movie that lasts 2 hours and people will watch it and they go, oh, that's nice. What's next?
Well, apparently the LA lobby, or the lobby of the Los Angeles office of Netflix, is now the place to be seen.
Yeah. Sure, they're handing out cash. I'd be there too. We'll pitch to them with our production company. Trust me.
Yeah, Quibi, cancel our meeting. Now, a new album tops the Billboard charts, and they're not waiting for the actual chart to let you know about it. Yes, Billboard announces that a multi-artist compilation from the hip-hop Dreamville label is the latest to hit number one on the Billboard Top 200 chart. Led by J. Cole, the 18-track set features a range of acts from the indie label and is the latest compilation or collective to score with fans in this playlist crazy time. However, if you actually go to the Billboard chart, it still features last week's champ, Chris Brown, at number one. But go to the Rolling Stone charts, which are updated all the time and not just once a week, and you'll find Revenge of the Dreamers 3 sitting pretty. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, we still say it's a big whoop that Rolling Stone is not going to supplant Billboard for a long time to come. And there's some power in saying, hey, this was the biggest song of the week, rather than some song that spikes up for an hour or a day or two and then drops back down. You know, it's showing the staying power for a week matters more than, you know, briefly being number one for a day or two. But, you know, I think it's interesting. And, you know, Rolling Stone's making that point. Hey, look, we're timely. We're on the top. We're showing it all the time. If I want to know what the number one song is going to be, maybe I'm checking into Rolling Stone every day. Because right now, Billboard just announced Old Town Road is number one for the 15th week in a row. The all-time record is 16 weeks. That's only held by two tracks in all of history. And Old Town Road just came out with a new remix featuring a verses sung by Young Thug. And I love this 12-year-old country singer Mason Ramsey, that little kid who went on Ellen DeGeneres. He has a verse where he's singing about being on his scooter. It's hilarious. But anyway, the point
is that the same song? Does it get
it does. I don't know how they decide that. But yes, the remixes with Billy Ray Cyrus and then these new ones with them, it all counts as one song somehow. I don't know how the rules work, but that's what it is.
Well, and keep in mind that there are charts for the United Kingdom. There's charts for France.
Sure. Of course. Yeah. We're talking about North America.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I then went to said, oh, I wonder. And I went to Rolling Stone. And in fact, they show a different song at number one, a new song by Post Malone that just came out. Also, ironically, featuring a singing by Young Thug. But the point is, if I go back tomorrow and the next day, and I keep seeing the Post Malone song at number one, or if it drops back down and Old Town Road goes back up, that will give me an early indication of what might happen next week on the Billboard charts. And maybe if I'm trying to be that savvy or care enough, I might start going there to get a day-by-day update on how songs are tracking.
Well, you know, we talked about James Bond, and one of my favorite lines in all those movies is, you know, when he says, my name is Bond, Jamie Bond. Wait, what? Yeah, according to what I'm reading here, news outlets all over the world are repeating a scoop from UK's Daily Mail. We know in the next Bond film that 007 is retired and pulled back into the fray. What? He's retired?
Yes, he's in Jamaica, retired, and he's trying to get out of the business. And they're like, okay. No, they pull him back in again.
Well, the Mail cites anonymous sources who say that early in the film, it's revealed that the current 007 is actress Lashana Lynch, last seen in Captain Marvel as a fighter pilot and best pal to the heroine, who, by the way, is Captain Marvel. And it's not a kicker. It's not something that happens at the end of the film. The Daily Mail quotes an insider saying that very early in the movie, we're in the office with M, you know, the person in charge, who says, "Come in, 007, and there she is. Lynch is in the film credits named only as Nomi. Big deal or big whoop?
Can you answer this for me?
It's probably a big deal.
No. The answer is Daily Mail. Why is the entire world outlets, why is all respectable media repeating crap from the Daily Mail? 99% of the time, the crap that they scoop everybody on is BS. It's not true, especially when it's about entertainment and the royals. They have a great track record of making crap up or just getting it wrong. And so everybody to repeat this breathlessly, maybe it's true because one time out of 100, they're right, but they constantly make stuff up and just throw it out there, get clickbait. Everybody repeats it excitedly. So according to the Daily Mail, and then next week they move on to something else. It's irresponsible to repeating junk peddled by the Daily Mail. Shame on everybody for doing it. I'm so annoyed at people doing that. It's just ridiculous. When you know they're a bad outlet and they can't be trusted, you should not be repeating the crap that they put out there just so they can get clickbait. And this is what
I'm
you
just
know,
looking
is the
at
problem
the Daily Mail's website now. Wow. I haven't been on that website in ages.
Well,
it's very
the most,
salacious.
One of the most popular in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's why everybody imitates it and tries to mimic their layout and the way. That's why Huffington Post looks the way it does, because they've been imitating the Daily Mail. And, you know, they all want clickbait. They all want stuff. But it's one thing to have clickbait. It's another thing to just peddle false stories, which they do constantly. So, you know, quoting them as a reputable news source is ridiculous. And shame on everybody. I mean, we're talking every news outlet in the world repeated it. Like, well, they can just say what the Daily Mail said, and that gives them cover because they get to put an exciting headline about James Bond and the next 007. And
again, you mean Bond,
once in a while,
Jamie
they're true.
Bond?
Yeah, exactly. And again, that's the whole thing here. It's not that James Bond is being played by a woman. It's that there's a new 007 played by a woman. So that's
well, what
not
happens?
Even,
what happens if it's true? Then do we have to come back and eat crow?
Of course not. Because once in a while, the Daily Mail gets something right. But to repeat something they say is ridiculous because they're not a trustworthy news source. So the fact that you know National Enquirer gets it right sometimes, but it doesn't mean you start repeating their stories as if it's good news.
Well, you know, here in Los Angeles over the weekend, in a completely unrelated piece of news, Paul mm-hmm. McCartney played his last show of his you know most recent tour
with his mate Ringo on drums.
Yes, and apparently it was absolutely phenomenal. But is the live music business itself in a slump? Total grosses for the top 100 tours worldwide are down significantly from 1 year ago. The 2.6 billion, 60 million. Yeah, it's down 25% from the 2.8 billion, and that's $2.8 billion business from the first half of 2018. Pulling back, the news does indeed look grimmer. Ticket sales are down indeed at their lowest in a decade. And of course, ticket prices are going in only one direction, up, hitting a first ever average of more than $100 in the top 50 tours. So higher ticket prices, the widespread use of dynamic pricing, lower grosses, and the fewest ticket sales in a decade. Yes, an extra big act touring would have goosed the numbers, but it's possible pop stars are pricing themselves out of an audience. Big deal or big whoop?
It is a big deal. You know, we talked about dynamic pricing before, how there were acts that like Taylor Swift and others, not to pick on her, a lot of people are doing this, using dynamic pricing. They're saying, okay, we don't care about selling out. We want to make sure we get the full value for our tickets. So they're making tons of money. They've got some empty seats and they feel like they are both one, frustrating scalpers, and two, getting the money themselves rather than selling a ticket and having it resold for a lot more money. Fair enough, but look what's happening. The lowest ticket sales in a decade. People just go, wow, I can't afford to go to, I can't remember the last time I went to a concert in anything other than a small venue because it's just too damn expensive and it's not that fun. But from Broadway to live concerts to cable television to ebooks and even going to the movies all the time, everybody is pricing themselves out of the business. People are just saying, wow, I can't afford this. That's why they're switching to streaming or they're switching to their library or they're switching to, not going to the Broadway show. You know, it's just, you can't keep pricing things more and more and more. It just doesn't work.
Asterisk, see HBO Max story earlier in the episode.
Yeah, exactly. Boy, we're both losing our voice.
Mine is from screaming about the price of HBO Max. No, just kidding.
We wouldn't even know what it is yet.
That's true. But that does conclude big deal or big whoop for this week and moves us along into inside baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, how this, I guess it's two stories, how they affect you will be, it could change some of the TV shows that you might see presented to you in the future.
Well, we're talking to the biz mostly anyway. I mean, we've got viewers from all over the world, listeners, people listening in from Australia and Hong Kong and of course the UK and France and Germany, stuff like that. But we have a lot of people in the biz here in North America. We've got casual fans, but a lot of our listeners do work in the industry. So I think this really does impact them. I mean, we're talking about big changes in TV production. One change could involve the funding of reality TV in the US for a lot of people, and the others are real doozy. It's completely changing how profit participants get paid on hit TV shows. Not that I've ever had points on a show, but you know, you want to change that, something they've been doing for decades? I'm sure that'll be uncontroversial. What's first?
Well, what's first is Discovery. I guess there's a new CEO over there at the Discovery Network, and he's from the EU. And he's looking at how reality shows are made in the EU and saying, you know what, we should do the same thing in the US. In the UK, I guess what they do is they say, look, a production company, you go out, you fund it, and then bring us the show and we'll buy it. By the way, you'll get to keep the rights.
But well, you spoiled the kicker at the end.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that is the kicker. You're right. I usually generally just read all the notes and then kind of like wing it. But really, okay. So we all know Discovery is a conglomerate that owns, you know, what, like Animal Planet, obviously the Discovery Channel. I think it owns the Food Network.
Yeah, the Cooking Channel, HGTV, yeah. TLC, a lot of reality channels in the US. That's kind of their thing.
Right. And so the new guy in town is from the UK. He wants to change the model. And in the US, production companies, they get paid like a licensing fee, and then they produce each episode with that money.
Well, and they get paid as the episodes come in. So they get money, a stream of money coming in.
Right.
So in the EU, the outside production company has to fund the entire show themselves up front. In the US, you get a steady stream of money that helps you keep going. And you don't have to have a huge amount of money up front. You don't have to take out a big loan in order to do it. So Discovery said, well, we're going to the EU model. You're going to have to take out a big loan and make sure you can fund the whole thing up front, or we're not going to commit to it, obviously. And if you need help, here, go to this... Go to our friends here. You know, they'll give you a loan and put you soaked up to your neck in debt. Knock yourself out. So the question is, why are those two systems so radically different? Well, you gave the spoiler. There's one big reason. At the end of the day, in the US, the content is owned by the cable channel. That's why they're sending them a steady stream of money. They get to keep the show and they own all the rights. In the EU, it's owned by the outside production companies. That's why they shoulder the cost, because they get the valuable content for their own library and they can sell it or reformat it all over the world. So when you saw, UK Idol, what was it called? Pop Idol, being repurposed around the world, you weren't dealing with the TV channel that carried it. You were dealing with the independent production company that created it and funded it and made it happen.
Right.
Those
that was
are
like,
the people
wasn't
that
Simon
made all that.
Cowell,
yeah, like, well, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he was one of the people that he had to go off on his own because he wanted more money. So he was not a player. He wasn't an owner in the company. He ended up doing his own. That's why he launched X Factor. And again, that wasn't owned by, say, Fox in the US or somebody else. That was owned by him. Right. So this is a radical change to how a lot of reality television is produced in the US. And it's like, well, okay, if you want us to fund everything on our own, we should get to keep it. But that's not part of the deal, is it?
No.
Discovery's not saying that. They're just saying, hey, we don't want this bother of having to send out money all the time.
Let me translate this for anybody who may not understand this. I'm going to translate this into the simplest terms. Okay. Discovery is saying, we would very much like you to pay for making our cake. We would like to eat it and then afterwards pretty much still have it.
You can clean up the cake. You can clean up the plate.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's also the issue of reshoots and other stuff that happens as a show progresses. You know, you want changes or things become more expensive. Right now, they're partners on that in the US. You know, some things need to be reshoot or redone. Well, everybody's working together because they've already been sending money to you. Everybody's sort of committed equally. If you're on the hook all on your own, suddenly the cable channel doesn't have that same impetus to cooperate with you and, you know, say, well, all right, let's work together to make this happen. They might just say, oh, tough. It's your show. You know, we already committed to what we're going to pay you, and we're not going to pay you a penny till it shows up. So it's going to create a lot of problems. I don't see, you know, without giving up ownership rights, I don't see how they can demand this, but we'll have to see what happens.
Well, what'll be interesting to see is whether other networks follow suit, And B, whether production companies turn and say, hey, we have this great project. It would be perfect for Discovery. Oh, you know what? We're not going to go to Discovery. We're going to go to some other network.
Yeah.
And so if Discovery starts losing out on certain series, then, right. Yeah, then they'll have to rethink their
So that's
their
a pretty
business.
Big change, but it's only coming from one. It's a big player in cable, Discovery. They own a lot of channels, but it's only coming from one player. Here's a big change being pushed by two people, and they're two big ones, Disney and Warner Brothers. They are
Don't
pushing,
you mean Disney and HBO Max?
They're pushing for a... Yeah, Warner Brothers might as well just rename themselves HBO. They're pushing for a new back-end model for all of TV. Historically, of course, you're on a hit TV show. You're the creator, the producer, or the star, maybe. You have some points on the show. You have some back-end participation. And then if the show comes back for a third year and something looks like a hit, you renegotiate. You get more points, more money, blah, blah, blah. You
see, and then eventually it all lands in a lawsuit where everybody's self-dealing.
Then it goes to syndication like Friends or Seinfeld, and there's so much money. You may sue eventually, but still, everybody's making a lot of money. There's money pouring in for everybody, but that doesn't happen for a long, long time. You get paid up front for work, but that big payday, that comes years in the future once, you know, you've syndicated and start to cash out 5, 6, 7, 8 years after the show begins. If it never cashes out and they pretend it fails, that's when you sue. So that's the old model. The new model is they're going to give you points that are worth a certain value just because you're on the show. It's a sitcom or a drama. They say, okay, this is what that point is worth. And you may be a star, you may be the creator or writer or whatever, and then you get paid right away. Money starts coming in right away because you got a show on the air. And the longer it runs, the more money you make. And presumably, if it's a big, big hit and goes beyond 3 seasons, 4 seasons, then you renegotiate, just like the Stranger Things kids did, and you would get more money for that point. It's not based on saying, all right, where did we sell it to? How much money did we make in syndication? It has a set value. They just want to say, let's make this simpler for everybody. Because, like you said, they don't want to deal with lawsuits like in Bones. They don't want to have to deal with the headache of self-dealing where they want to put a show on their own cable channel or streaming service and have to worry about, did they get fair value for it? They just want to say, let's change back-end deals forever. Now, imagine that. The Writers Guild are saying, let's end what talent agents have been doing for 2 decades now. Let's change that completely. These people want to change how you cash out on a big hit TV show forever. The way that's been done for decades now, for 30, 40 years, 50 years. That's a big, big change in how the business works. So instead of profit participants figuring out their cut years down the road, once it shows a profit, under the Disney model, everyone gets points and starts profiting right away. Hey, but at a predetermined level. The longer a show runs,
it's funny
the more money they get.
This, because it all has to do with streaming.
Right.
That's really what this has to do with because they realize
this is the way streamers do it. Streamers already do
correct.
This. There is no back end, so they have to pay more up front because they know
really,
there's no syndication.
So really, this is Disney and Warner Brothers getting into streaming and realizing that they, we're going to stave off a whole bunch of lawsuits here because what's going to wind up happening is we're going to do all these shows in the traditional way, and we know where they're going. They're going to Disney Plus. They're going to what is now called HBO Max, and then all of these stars, all of these creators are going to come at us and say, "Hey, wait a second! If we had we did this at the original,
they know they get more money up front, but they're saying we want to do this for shows on ABC." As well. We want to do this for shows wherever they are. It's not just for the streaming shows. It's for every show. That's what they're saying. They're changing it for everything.
Right.
Because they don't want to have two contracts. They don't want to have to deal with the headache of where it is and whatever. And they say for most of the shows, most of the time, the idea is to simplify. Let's assume they're not just trying to rip people off. They don't want to force those making the show to wait years to make money. Isn't that nice? Let's end the debates and court battles over where and how would be the most profitable place to sell a series. Let's not fight over whether airing it on their own cable channel versus a competitor wasn't smart, because you'll make the same money either way. It's a formula agreed upon by the start. And hey, they're saying, look, we want to maximize profits on the show too. You know, we want to have this show do what's best for a long run. And if that means our own streaming service after airing on Disney Channel or on ABC, let us do that, because you'll get your money no matter what. The problem is, of course, this is not being done so studios can give more money to talent, right? They're not saying, how can we give people more money? And the people just want to make sure they're not getting less money. But is that going to work? I mean, it is the way streamers do it, and studios are trying to adapt it. So do you think it's an end run where they're just trying to say, hey, let's just end the facade that we're going to give you any money anyway. Let's just keep it simple and say, look, you're not going to get that big payday at the end of the day.
No, I think that they see that, it's just easier for them. It's way easier for the studios to just say, you
keep more money. It's easier for them to keep more money, or it's easier for them accounting wise?
Across the board. Mm-hmm. To keep more money, to stave off lawsuits, to not have to, the accounting headache for years and years of who was on what show.
Oh, do we have to show you how much money we made?
Right, exactly.
Or the line and the dishonesty of pretending the shows aren't profitable.
Right. In other words, somebody sat down and said, do you realize that at this point we're losing as much money in all these lawsuits as if we had just paid out the money originally? Anyway?
Well, they aren't doing that yet.
Yeah, well, I think also, you know, you've got, yes, they're making these shows for ABC. They know eventually they'll be on the Disney streaming service. And it's like, okay, well, if we do those shows in the traditional format and then sell them to ourselves, we're going to get nailed for self-dealing. So why don't we just self-deal from the very beginning, let everybody know we're doing it, but pay people more up front, kind of like Netflix does.
Well, it still sounds like a loser for the artists.
Well, it is. It absolutely is, and everybody has said that. From, you know, they're basically saying there is no more back end, and the back end was very profitable for many people for many, many years.
Let's just say not many, right? The idea is, well, there weren't that many hit shows. Most shows weren't hits. That's the studio's argument. They're like, look, most shows were never hits. You know, a lot of shows are not hits. Maybe you get more money up front for smaller shows. And guess what? If shows run for 3 seasons, you make more money because shows aren't running 5 years and 100 episodes anymore.
I mean, Kirk Cameron today is probably making more money from his appearances on Growing Pains than he is from the work he does today.
Well, that would be true of anybody in a really big hit network show, assuming they're a star who can get points.
Right. I mean, which, right, he was a star.
Right. I mean, so you're not picking on Kirk Cameron. You're just saying.
No. I'm just trying to pick on somebody who, like, if I picked Ted Danson, that wouldn't make sense.
Well, of course. Well, why not?
Well, because he's
making more money from reruns of Cheers than he is from what?
The Good
and
Place.
From his other shows, you know, he's had like 2 hit shows.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. So what's he making more money on? His appearances in movies?
No. The Good Place. He's on The Good Place.
Oh. Well, that's a much bigger hit show. So, I mean, he's in. Yeah. So he's got a 3rd hit show. So I don't think
so
that's
what
a good
I'm trying to say.
Comparison.
Is he's probably, I mean, because, you know, it's royalties. It's not it's not, you know, a paycheck. What I was trying to say is Kirk Cameron, who isn't on a show, or maybe he is, but not on a big giant hit network show.
He's had one hit and Ted Danson's had at least 3. So I don't think Kirk Cameron's making more money than Ted Danson. That's, you said Kirk Cameron's making more money than Ted Danson.
Okay, pick,
I don't think that makes any sense.
Pick somebody else then, but somebody that's working today, who was on a hit television show in the past.
Well, then they're doing better.
Those paychecks might be even. Whereas Kirk Cameron, who's not on a hit show today, might act every now and again, is probably making more from his appearances.
I don't know why this is a silly comparison. You make a lot of money from a hit show. You can live all your whole life on one big hit show if you're a player and get to have a chunk of it. Jerry Seinfeld never needs to work again a day in his life.
Yes.
Forget Cars with comedians. I mean, the man's, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars just from one hit show. That's the jackpot winnings that people think about, but vast majority of shows are not Friends or Seinfeld or even The Office, right?
And no, they're like Showbiz Sandbox.
That's right.
You get paid a mint.
That's right. So, you know, what about hits like Stranger Things? Well, everyone does renegotiate. What about late bloomers like The Office? Well, that's even rarer, really, than smash hits like Friends and The Big Bang Theory, some show that runs 9 seasons but's never a big hit but then blossoms in streaming. But hey, it ran for 9 seasons. So they probably got really good money, even though it was never a monster in the ratings.
Well, I wonder what that would do. It would actually, you know, make the whole argument with the packaging fees moot, wouldn't it?
What would this new system? Absolutely. Yes. No, it will definitely roil the system and have a big effect on those questions about packaging fees. What is the talent agents going to be getting? You know, under this new system, what do the talent agents get? There's no back end. So what are they participating in? So yeah, it actually affects those things. What about shows canceled after 2 or 3 years? Well, obviously they can be profitable. They don't make shows for 3 years if they're losing money, but they're not going 5 years and getting 20 episodes a year. So they're not syndicating them either, which I think is a mistake. So everything's changed. A lot of shows are just running 3 seasons. They don't want to have to deal with back ends. They're not always taking shows to syndication. They're saying, let us do this new simple system. So then you'll never have to argue with us about getting money because we won't ever pretend you're going to get it. That seems to be what the gist of it is.
Well, there's one person who doesn't really, you know, need to worry about this at all.
Who's that?
Rip Torn.
That's right. Rip Torn has headed off to the inner circle of thought.
Wait, what? Oh, that's from Defending Your Life, isn't it?
That's right. Rip Torn has died at the age of 88, thanks to our listener, Jesse Spencer Smith, who reached out via Twitter with that little joke, letting me know that he had died. You know, alcohol abuse sidelined his career for quite a while. He was a crazy, wild character, considered difficult to deal with to a degree, but he survived long enough to become beloved. You know, if you just hang around long enough, everybody just ends up loving you. He was an Oscar nominee for the film Cross Creek, quite a delightful little movie. A Tony nominee for his role in Tennessee Williams' Sweet Bird of Youth, opposite Paul Newman and Geraldine Page, who he later married. And then he made his film debut even before that in Baby Doll, directed by, wasn't that Elia Kazan?
I believe so, yes.
Then he dove into New York acting and the Lee Strasberg School. He said to his cousin, hey, Sissy Spacek, get over here. This stuff is easy. There's money to be made. Brought her out to the entertainment business. Got a key role in The Cincinnati Kid opposite Steve McQueen. And then Terry Southern, a funny comic writer, wrote the script Easy Rider for Rip Torn. He had Rip Torn in mind for the lead role. And he lost out on it. And for once, he wasn't the crazy one. Dennis Hopper drew a knife on him. Torn left, and the role went to Jack Nicholson.
Always wonder, like, would Torn's career have been that much different if he had stayed?
No, absolutely not. Well, he drew a knife on him. Clearly, you're not going to stay. The guy's a crazy person.
And no, Hopper, but I mean, like, you know, Jack Nicholson without Easy Rider would still be Jack Nicholson, right? I mean,
but I don't think Easy Rider would have been Easy Rider with Rip Torn in it.
Good point.
You know, it's just, you know, it's Casablanca with Ronald Reagan, you know. He had multiple marriages, lots of problems, but he kept on acting. And then he had a big return to success when Defending Your Life, where Albert Brooks cast him as a lawyer in that movie. Gary Shandling saw the film, thought he was great, and cast him as the conniving producer Artie on The Larry Sanders Show, one of the great sitcoms of all time. And he won multiple Emmy nominations and finally won the Emmy in 1996. Then he departs in the woman from Saturday Night Live. Oh, I never watch her show with Alec Baldwin.
Oh,
Smarty Pants, Bossy Pants.
Yeah, Tina Fey.
Tina Fey. Oh.
And 30 Rock.
30 Rock. Thank you. Never liked it, but he had a recurring role on that show.
But you remember the name of her book.
I do. You look at his credits and the top-notch talent that worked with him when he was capable of working. It really speaks to his talent. Everyone from Alfred Hitchcock to Meryl Streep. I mean, despite all the spottiness in his career and the big gaps and not great periods when nobody worked with him, he still got roles from people who were really, really smart, good, and talented people. So clearly this guy was a real talent for the ages as much as he tried to mess it up.
Now, what is this note that you have here about Harold Robbins?
Well, you know, I think in our obit for Harold Robbins, we mentioned that we quoted the idea that he had sold 750 million copies of his books. And I thought, really? And I kept looking and kept digging deeper. The only firm figures I could ever see for any single book, and this stuff isn't easy to track down, were for The Carpetbaggers. That's probably his most popular book. And one claim was that it sold 8 million copies, which is a lot. That's a lot of copies for a book. 8 million copies is probably his most popular. And if that's his most popular book, even though those are figures only for the United States, there's no way he gets anywhere near 700 million copies worldwide. I think that's just more of the nonsense and lies and puffery that Harold Robbins spat out like breakfast. You know, he always spun stories and told him. So he's the sort of guy who would just say, it sold 400 million, 500, 700. And once it gets repeated a couple of times, everybody thinks it's true. But since I can't find anything remotely like any good firm figures for his books, I think that figure is way off and we should have not said it. And, you know, we talk about sad news all the time, people dying. Why not wish happy birthday to somebody? I just realized it's Linda Ronstadt's birthday today, July 15th, Monday, July 15th. It's her birthday, one of the great singers of all time. Happy birthday to Linda Ronstadt.
Well, Linda, if you heard that and you want to thank Michael personally, you can email him dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
Yeah, tell me what you're reading because she reads a lot.
dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also, of course, leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And that information, along with ways to subscribe to our show, and please do subscribe to our show, rate and review our show. It does help us out when you do. It helps other people find the show when you do. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You can subscribe to us, by the way, on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, Google Play, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Soon, Spotify. I am working on that. So we're going to be there as well. That information, again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is where you will find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. That is where you will find links to our Twitter account at showbizsandbox. That is where you will find links to our Facebook page, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, showbizsandbox.com is our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's wickedgoogly.co.uk.
I have a feeling that's a cricket reference. I believe it is, based on the amount of cricket I watched in New Zealand. So I'm going to go with cricket on that one. But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, or know how to spell it, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.